Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time is Stephen Debrow, director of a new documentary named 18th and Grand, the Olympic Auditorium story. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
The film that we're going to be talking about is 18th and Grand, and it's the story of the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles, California. And that's kind of where I wanted to start, because some of our listeners may not be familiar with this venue. Would you maybe like to introduce it and tell us what makes it so historic?
Yeah, well, the Olympic was the house of boxing, wrestling, roller derby, and music events, and particularly notable on the music side for some of the punk rock shows where the promoter Golden Voice really got their, cut their teeth, so to speak. They're the ones who now put on Coachella, but their beginnings were in the hardcore punk scene, and the Olympic was the biggest hardcore punk venue in the world at the time, back in the early to mid 80s. So the Olympic was built in 1925, as LA was booming. And so it was around the same time that the Hollywood Bowl was built and a lot of the city was being developed rapidly. And, so it was the largest auditorium in the West. It was LA's answer to Madison Square Garden in New York. And, it's my fascination with the story was that its rise and fall kind of paralleled the city, and it became an interesting way to sort of tell a new story of Los Angeles, or tell the story of Los Angeles through this prism of this sort of fight palace. So that's the background a little bit on the building.
No, I'd like to know a little more actually about that fascination that you just mentioned. Do you think that there's an origin to it as well, beyond what you just revealed, what you just shared with us?
The origin of my fascination? Yes. Well, having grown up in Los Angeles, I did live away. I lived in New York for 10 years, but I was born and raised here and live here now. It was always on television, the Olympic, and it was always sort of surreal as a kid, because the wrestling and roller derby were kind of fantastic and wild. These were days, when television, this was pre-cable, and when you had a limited number of channels, the Olympic was always on TV. And as a kid growing up, it captured my imagination. The roller derby was very big here for a period of time through the 20th century. And the LA T-Birds was the roller derby team here. And they always seemed to be coming back and winning at the very end, miraculously in the last seconds. And the skating was great, and there was fighting, and it was bizarre. And that was sort of locked into my memories, as was wrestling. And my dad was a big boxing fan, and we watched, there was Thursday night boxing from the Olympic, and then they had championship fights on Saturday nights. And so it was part of my childhood I'd kind of forgotten about, or it was just deep in the recesses of my memories. But I was introduced through a friend to the photography of a guy named Theo Arrett, and he was the house photographer at the Olympic from the mid-60s through the early 80s. And the photographs were so vivid and so epic, so larger than life, that it stimulated an interest in delving into the story and the origins of the place. And once I went down this rabbit hole, it got deeper and deeper. And one of the most fascinating things about the Olympic was that it was run by a woman for 40 years, almost 40 years, named Eileen Eaton. Her story was so interesting. The story of the building, the story of how it was created, and how it was financed, and the era and the eras throughout, and its connections to films, its connections to organized crime, its connections to so many aspects of the LA story, and in strong ways in the Mexican American story. It just felt so quintessentially Los Angeles that it just drew me in.
Yeah, and when we talk about Eileen Eaton, having watched the film, I realized that she was really a trailblazing woman in her field. So it sort of resonates to this day particularly.
Yes, I think so. Eileen was a really remarkable person. I mean, if you think about, you know, the 20th century and women running large companies, running large organizations, would be an outlier in any sense, in any field. And to do what she did in boxing and wrestling and keeping this building that was in the years prior to her taking over was a financial disaster. And then in the years after she left, it really couldn't continue very well. That she was a remarkable trailblazer and a brilliant promoter and a smart business person who had, as it says in the film, never seen a fight before she got the job. And so, yes, I think it's her story is very timely. And I was honored to sort of discover it. Not that I'm the only person who knows about Eileen Eaton, but she's kind of a forgotten person in not just sports history, but in Los Angeles history. And, you know, for years, she was the only woman, you know, there was like 1,000 men and one woman in the International Boxing Hall of Fame in New York. It was Eileen Eaton. And so that tells you something.
Yeah, I'm thinking as well, was that the idea of filmmaking as a way to tell these stories again, to rediscover these people, a driving factor that actually led you to make this movie? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, this is your feature directorial debut.
Yes, it was. It was a challenging film to do as a first film, and went through many sort of iterations. I knew the story that I wanted to tell fairly, but it was very tricky to tell the story of Eileen, the building, and the city, and interweave that narrative in a satisfying way. So it took a long time, and I was also really interested in preserving the history. And really, you know, I did 50 interviews for the film, and they were, you know, they're in-depth interviews that chart a social history of Los Angeles through these different musicians, you know, skaters, wrestlers, boxers, and the insiders and fans who were part of the Olympic. And so it was really... It was more than just, I want to make a documentary. It was, I want to preserve this history as cultural history, because if I didn't do it, those stories would be gone. I mean, we underestimate, and I think right now it's particularly timely in the time of COVID when so many of our elders have, you know, have died, and how this has disproportionately hit a population who's, when they're gone, with most of these people, their stories are gone. That history is gone. That connection to the past is gone. So that's another part that I kind of feel like is important about this film, and is that it's a memory project, and it was a chance to capture some real characters whose time, you know, has gone, but whose you know, hopefully memory lives on through this film.
I was thinking we'd left off talking about the importance of preserving the memory of people and the older generations, but I was also thinking of how so many businesses and venues have had to shut down because of the COVID crisis. So do you feel that that's another way in which your documentary resonates?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I hope it, I mean, to me, it's a very, you know, in one way, it's very particular, and one way it's very general, in the sense that, you know, it's an LA story in America and around in many places around the world. There were boxing scenes and boxing clubs, wrestling scenes and wrestling clubs, and arenas, venues that mattered. and that still matter in some cases. In some cases, they're struggling to survive, and hopefully they do, and hopefully they're revitalized. We've lost so much right now, and I think that it's almost since we're still in it, it's hard to get any kind of distance to see exactly what we've lost. And what is gone for good and what might come back and in what form. So it's a really, I feel like the film resonates beyond Los Angeles and touches upon themes that are universal and that involve something that's very heartfelt, because the way we experience live events, music and other, music and sports, they're so indelibly sort of etched into our memories and our hearts and our souls, especially in those days before we, everyone felt the need to experience them through our phones. And which is to me such a fool's errand, because you're taking the picture, you're missing the moment, you're recording the video. Are you ever going to look at that again? But if you just feel and experience the moment, it's so much more potent. So in any case, I don't mean to digress, but this idea of memory and this idea of vitality of live experience and vitality of live music and live venues is something that I think is deep and connected to the human soul.
Yeah, and we're definitely missing it right now. I mean, speaking from personal experience, during this time, I've definitely missed my live music, my, film screenings, all of that stuff. And, we'll just have to wait and see if things will ever get back to the way they were before. So watching a film like yours, in a way, definitely made me feel that just energy, like you said, of experiencing these things live. And I think part of that energy is also reflected in the music that was selected for the film. And I wondered whether that was something else that was an important aspect of the film, also given your background of working in the music industry for, two decades.
Yes. Music is deep in my heart, and is part of my, the parts of my nerve endings that pop. And it was really important to me that the film was vibrant musically. The venue was a pop culture, place. It was not, this wasn't a Carnegie Hall. And so, I wanted it to have a visceral, the soundtrack and the score to be visceral and dynamic. And I also wanted it to be true to Los Angeles. So all of the music that is, that's in the film, it's a very music driven film. It's all LA related or Olympic Auditorium related one way or another. The bands, that I chose, along with Howard Parr, my music supervisor, for the, that are the licensed tracks, are all LA related or played the Olympic. So that can range from Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band to the Dead Kennedys to War and the Weirdos doing a Love cover. So that's double LA. It's an LA song performed by another LA punk band. And then the band that scored the film is a band called Jungle Fire, and they're they're from Los Angeles as well, or LA diaspora. The leader of the group is Colombian but lives in Los Angeles. And so the music was really, really important to me, and was very, it was a challenge for an independent film to clear all of these big tracks. But because we're an independent film, people were very kind to us. And because Howard, works on a lot of other major films, that they were willing to cut our little indie some, it wasn't inexpensive, but it wasn't, people were flexible, and we worked within a budget to get some incredible music, like, Shuggy Otis and Queens of the Stone Age. And I mean, this is, no slouches, big songs. But I felt like they were really, they added to the tapestry and the authenticity of the film.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They definitely, definitely add something to it. And we were talking about it earlier a little bit. So aside from the great music, you've got, you know, a wealth of archive material, interviews with experts and some of the people who contributed to writing the story of the Olympic Auditorium, as well as stylized animation, some great camera work. So there's a lot going on. And you did mention that maintaining a sort of balance was a little challenging, but also how long did it take you to work on this project?
I was going to say too long, but it took about, I was looking back through the paperwork of my releases, and I started shooting interviews in 2014. And so it took about 6 years. We were set to premiere at the Cinerama Dome last March, and COVID just, nipped us in the bud, and we had to cancel it then. So it was about 6 years, 6 to 7 years of production and post-production. So it was more than I bargained for when I started, and I look at it now and I'm really proud of it, but it was a challenge. It was a challenge in so many ways. And we have so much material above and beyond this that, you know, my hope is that, and our plan is to continue to find ways to get that material out there, whether that's in the form of short films, additional feature films that spin off, because, you know, for example, you know, the punk rock section, for example, is very, but I think it warrants its own documentary in and of itself, and I practically have enough to do it with what I have. Wrestling, professional wrestling, and the intricacies and history of wrestling, I really couldn't give everything the length that, unless I wanted to make it a mini series, which it could have been, but I didn't have the financing, I didn't have the ability to do that. I wanted the film, I made a distinct decision to make it move quickly and feel visceral and intense, and it's 83 minutes long. So it's, you get on and you strap on and you go. And so the other parts are still around, and I'm talking to different people about how we might expand upon the project and do more, release more material and do extended projects, but 6 years plus.
Yeah. Well, so, there is a life to the project beyond the actual film.
Yes. It's always been the reason I have, I have a side sort of, it's 18th and Grand, the Olympic Auditorium story, the documentary, but it's also the Olympic Auditorium project. Because what I've discovered so much is how much it resonates, how much the Olympic, even though it's been closed now for some period of time, how much it resonates with people. I get messages literally on a daily basis from people who say, my grandfather, fought at the Olympic, or I have these Olympic stories. I used to go to the punk shows and I have these incredible stories, is, make it an ongoing cultural conversation within Los Angeles and then more broadly speaking. But I've done projects with and received a grant from the County of Los Angeles to do projects relating to the Mexican American history of the Olympic. And we brought in wrestlers, skaters, boxers, and historians to help tell those stories and how the Olympic connected to LA's Mexican American past. So that's just one way that the Olympic project, we're aiming to keep that going and build upon that and, create more live events as that becomes more possible again with COVID hopefully getting more under control and us being able to get back into live events or doing some combination of live and virtual events to make this not just a one-way presentation, because the Olympic story, I view it as a community project in so many ways, and a way for people to connect with their, going back to the idea of connecting with your elders, that way of of asking your grandfather, or, you know, hey, tell me about that story, or just connecting with one another to kind of remember our vital past and try to learn from it, both good and bad. What has happened? You know, what, you know, I mean, wrestling, you know, was filled with racial stereotypes, some of them quite ugly. Those are conversations that I don't really get into in the film because I don't have that. It's not within this film to kind of delve into, but it is part of, it's part of the good and the bad with all of this, this with the past, you know. You know, I try to undercut the inherent nostalgic nature that one could have for this film and this material, because I feel like, you know, history is always a mixed bag. You know, it's never, oh, it was all great before. If we could just return to the past, everything would be fine. I think that's foolishness. As much as I know you're a jazz fan, as much as I love 50s Blue Note records, I know that the music moved forward, whether I like it or not. You know, I can love an era of music and treasure it and find contemporary music less appealing to me in many ways. But that doesn't mean I think that we can all go back and try to go back in history and say, well, you know, that's only what's valid. And that it's one, unambiguously, the past is unambiguously better than where we are now. We are where we are. And we have to kind of find ways to use our past, to learn from our past, to move forward. At least that's what I believe.
Right. Yeah. We need to know where we've come from to know where we're going.
You put it much more concisely than I did. Yes.
Right. Well, Stephen, that's an amazing point. And I got to say, I absolutely love this film. And I do think it's also a great closing film. We haven't mentioned it yet, but it will be closing the Slam Dance Film Festival. Also because of that energy that I talked about and lacking all those live experiences right now in many parts of the world. I think it's just a perfect way to end an event like Slam Dance. So congratulations, Stephen, and thank you very much for joining us and talking with us about 18th and Grand.
Thank you very much, Matt. I appreciate it.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.